from KQED.
This is the California Report podcast. I'm Lily Jamali.
And I'm Michelle Wiley. The battle is intensifying in our state capitol over when police are allowed to shoot. Democratic Assemblywoman Shirley Weber introduced a new bill Wednesday that's got the support of civil liberties groups like the ACLU. It's their answer to a pro-law enforcement proposal floated a day earlier. Assemblywoman Weber says African-American and Latino parents live in a constant state of fear over the safety of their kids.
They can be in the right place. They can say the right thing, they can have the right attitude when approached by an officer and still find themselves in situations that take their lives.
Her bill is almost identical to a failed proposal she introduced last year that only allowed officers to use deadly force when absolutely necessary versus what an officer might reasonably do. That's the standard law enforcement wants to use. The two sides spent the last several months negotiating, but ultimately decided to each introduce their own bills this week.
We're going to come back to San Francisco now, where yesterday afternoon, firefighters were engrossed in a battle against a blaze in the city's inner Richmond neighborhood. Now, this was a fire that was caused by a ruptured high-pressure gas line, a line that is owned and operated by PG&E. And of course, it was reminiscent in some respects of the 2010 San Bruno pipeline explosion, which ended up killing 8 people. This did not leave anybody even injured. So glad to report that. But once again, PG&E in the spotlight over safety concerns. And on that note, PG&E has unveiled a new plan for wildfire safety that may lead to the utility shutting off power to more customers during times of extreme fire danger. KQED's Dan Brecky explains.
Electric utilities across the state were required to file safety plans with state regulators by yesterday. PG&E's plan is under special scrutiny because of the utility's involvement in a series of devastating wildfires over the last several years. The San Francisco-based utility said that it will expand the use of one tactic that it tried for the first time last year, shutting down power to some communities when high winds and low humidity raise fire danger to critical levels. The company says it will also widen the scope of inspections of its electrical equipment this year and launch an effort to remove or trim dangerous trees near power lines. PG&E's plan must be approved by the California Public Utilities Commission, which will hold a public workshop on wildfire safety plans next week. For the California Report, I'm Dan Brecky.
And as Dan mentioned there, this was something that utilities across the state were required to do to file these safety plans. Now, the state's second largest utility, Southern California Edison, also, of course, submitted its wildfire mitigation plan. In its $582 million plan, the company says it will enhance its inspection of overhead power lines, harden infrastructure, and remove more than 7,000 hazardous trees. Both of these utilities, PG&E and SoCal Edison, as you know well, Michelle, are facing a lot of lawsuits from the wildfires that happened just this past year and before then in PG&E's case.
And as some of our reporting has found, you know, we're still paying the bill from some of those lawsuits at us as PG&E. If you PG&E is your provider,
you're paying
that off every month.
From the 2001 bankruptcy.
Right.
First time that they went into bankruptcy. And actually, it's interesting because today, you know, they do these quarterly earnings. It's basically like, here's our report card every 3 months. Mm-hmm. Here's how we're doing. They were supposed to do that today. They're not because they are currently in Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. So we will not be hearing from management as we normally would and have a chance to pose some questions to them. They have been very quiet.
Well, I want to turn a little bit, Lily, and I want to ask you a question. What do you think of when you hear of voter rolls being purged?
I think of the South.
So in L.A. County, there is recently this settlement with a conservative group that has set off fears that there will be a mass purge of voter registration here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you said, in the South, in Ohio, actually, in Georgia, there are purges of these voter rolls. And a lot of civil rights groups say it can encourage disenfranchisement at the polls.
Definitely raises the hackles of a lot of members of the citizenry when you hear that.
Absolutely. But officials say that is not the case in L.A. And our reporter, Mary Franklin Harvin, is going to explain.
The suit filed against Secretary of State Alex Padilla and L.A. County Registrar Recorder Dean Logan alleged that L.A. County had over 1.5 million inactive voters on their rolls, meaning they weren't complying with a section of the National Voter Registration Act, which says that states must keep their voter list current. Conservative group Judicial Watch and the Election Integrity Project filed the suit. They say a glut of inactive voters enables foul play at the polls, like absentee ballot fraud or double voting. But officials say LA already has a voter verification system in place and is complying with the Voter Registration Act. Attorney Justin Levitt consulted the Secretary of State's office on this case.
There's been misinformation about the fact that people are going to get tossed off the rolls tomorrow. That's simply not going to happen.
That's because California uses a different process to verify voters. Rather than bumping people for inactivity like in other states, everyone on the inactive list is there because they've either moved or had mail returned, not for lack of voting. So why did officials agree to settle if they're not doing anything wrong? According to the Registrar Recorder's office, it would have been a waste of time and taxpayer money to litigate something they say they were already doing. Ray Lopez Calderon is the executive director for the nonpartisan voting rights group Common Cause. He says the real reason for the lawsuit is more about politics.
I don't think it's a coincidence that they sued in L.A. and that they, you know, named Alex Padilla as a co-defendant. It's part of this larger misinformation campaign that there's all these illegal voters in California, and it's complete poppycock.
As part of the settlement agreement, L.A. County will remove inactive records after the 2022 election. For the California Report, I'm Mary Franklin Harvin.
All right. Well, counties across California have been conducting homeless counts these last couple of weeks. We've been telling you about it. And one of the things we've done at the California Report with the help of our editor, Polly Stryker, and Rachel Miro, our colleague here at KQED, is looking at common myths about what it's like to be homeless. And Michelle Wiley, who is here in the studio with me, headed to Orange County to explore a myth that involves drug use. So, Michelle, why don't we start with why this myth? Why did you want to explore this particular myth?
So I think that there is a certain narrative about homelessness, and this is something that I have heard, you know, just anecdotally before, that the pervasiveness of drug use among people who are homeless. And I think that what we think is that people start using drugs and then they become homeless because they don't have enough money to feed their habit. You know, this is sort of particular timeline that we think people go through. And through my reporting in San Francisco, I found it can often be flipped. You know, homelessness is a complicated issue, and it can have lots of different reasons why people become homeless, one of which being the housing crisis in California. Mm-hmm. And I found there were a lot of people I talked to who said they began using drugs after they became homeless. They weren't using them before, but they were using them after, because living on the streets can be so physically and emotionally and mentally difficult, mm-hmm. and using drugs is one way to alleviate that.
And exhausting. You spoke with Mahan Naeem. Tell us who he is.
So Mahan is on the steering committee at the Orange County Needle Exchange Program. Now, this program doesn't actually exist anymore. It's been moved out of Orange County a couple of times. They used to operate in the Civic Center in Santa Ana, and then the city got upset with all the needle litter that was in the area and basically said, you can't operate here anymore. We don't want you in our area. The Needle Exchange then went to the California Department of Public Health.
In which city?
In Santa Ana.
Okay.
So Santa Ana kicked them out. They went to the Department of Public Health and said, we'll operate a mobile exchange and that'll help alleviate the needle litter problem because we won't be in one central location. We'll be driving around the county, bringing services to people. That got approved over the summer. And then Orange County at large, and then some particular cities in the county, filed a suit against the needle exchange to prevent it from operating. And that injunction was granted in November. So they have not been able to operate for the last year. So I spoke to Mahan Naeem at the Needle Exchange about what he's been doing since it closed.
Currently, not too much, but I'll be starting medical school at UC Irvine in August.
What kind of people would you meet at the exchange who are there to get clean syringes or naloxone, a drug that can help with overdoses? Can you describe the demographics of those folks?
We have an image, like as a society at large, of what a heroin user looks like. You know, this person is dirty, lives under a bridge, shares syringes, is a criminal. Well, in reality, I've never seen more diversity in my life than I did at the Civic Center at the Exchange. Like, opiate epidemic applies in the way epidemic normally applies. It doesn't pick and choose. I mean, we had moms coming from Newport Beach in really nice cars and really expensive clothing getting naloxone for their kids. I had people who were on their lunch breaks in full suits and name tags getting syringes. I also had homeless people. We had all kinds of people.
So do you hear this argument frequently that all homeless people are drug addicts?
we look at people's lives through the lenses of our own lives, and that doesn't apply to this situation. Like, I don't justify why people turn to substance use, but I don't think it's a mystery or a secret why somebody who now no longer has food, water, peace of mind, shelter, safety, sanitary living conditions craves a little bit of peace during their day and doesn't have access to mental health support, so you self-medicate. There are a lot of issues to solve, and I think we like to gravitate as a society towards, well, I don't live this life, so they should choose to not live this life, which is incredibly detached. I mean, to all the things that we just said, solving an opiate epidemic or a homelessness epidemic is complicated.
Thank you for that really interesting and illuminating conversation, Michelle. We're going to go to the Central Valley now, where this week President Trump nominated a former lobbyist for the Westlands Water District there as his next Secretary of the Interior. David Bernhardt has been the acting secretary since Ryan Zinke resigned. As KVPR's Monica Velez reports, Big Ag is praising the decision, but environmentalists say he pits farmers against fish.
Barbara Beer-Gampria is executive director of the grassroots group Restore the Delta. She says before his current job with the Interior Department, David Bernhardt tried to get more Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta water down to Westlands growers, fighting environmental protections for endangered salmon. He lost that battle, but Beer-Gampria worries he's going to try again.
David Bernhardt isn't just going to do the opposite of what the Delta needs. He's going to do the opposite of what the mission is for the Department of Interior to protect our natural resources.
But the CEO of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, Ryan Jacobson, says Bernhardt understands California and the Central Valley's agricultural water needs.
So the fact that we have an individual that understands both the plumbing side as well as the, you know, political side of what's happened with water in California, I think is an incredible asset for us at this point.
Bernhardt's agency proposed new environmental rules this week that could boost the water supply for Central Valley farmers. For the California Report, I'm Monica Velez in Fresno.
Next, we're going to go to Nevada.
What? This is the California Report.
I know. This is the California Report. But listen, this is important. So this week, Nevada became the first state in the country with a female majority in its state legislature. And so we wondered here at the California Report what lessons our state could learn from a place that's achieved a milestone like that. So from KUNR in Reno, political reporter Paul Boger has more.
The assembly will come to order. There is a quorum present.
The floor of the Nevada Assembly was packed this week with lawmakers and their families as they were sworn in to start the session.
I do solemnly swear that I will support.
While the start of Nevada's biennial legislature is always an occasion for a bit of pomp, this year was different. For the first time, female lawmakers outnumbered their male counterparts, with women holding just over 50% of the 63 seats in the Assembly and Senate combined. So how did a state like Nevada reach such a milestone before California, where women hold just 30% of the seats in the state legislature? Well, it's thanks in part to the growing number of Californians moving east. Fred Lockin is a political scientist at Truckee Meadows Community College in Reno. He says the influx of Californians to Clark and Washoe counties has pushed the state from historically red to blue.
We have clearly seen waves of Californians move to Nevada over the years. But in previous waves, we saw the disgruntled Republican business owner. And so that benefited the Republican Party. What we've seen now, I would say in the last 24 to 36 months, are folks coming from both Southern and Northern California that are drawn to the economy of Nevada, and many of those tend to be Democrats this time.
Jean Sinsdack is with the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. She says Nevada wasn't the only state that saw substantial gains of women in legislatures last year.
What we saw in 2018 is the very first time there was any kind of meaningful moving of the needle in terms of women's representation in state legislatures.
According to data collected by Sinsdack's organization, women account for roughly 28.5% of the total number of lawmakers in state legislatures nationwide, up more than 4% over 2016. But there are still outliers, including California, which has 36 women in the 120-member legislature.
The interesting thing is what I think we're seeing happen and why they're kind of falling into the middle of the pack a little bit is that other states are doing really well and have outpaced them in terms of their growth in women's representation.
The only other Western states with lower female representation than California are those dominated by Republicans, Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming. Almost all of the growth in terms of female lawmakers is on the Democratic side. The GOP has struggled in recent years to recruit women to run for office. For the California Report, I'm Paul Boger in Reno.
And that's the California Report for Thursday, February 7th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Michelle Wiley.
And I'm Lily Jamali. Have a great day.
Support for the California Report comes from Personal Capital, offering wealth management and online financial tools to help customers manage their money with transparency and control. More information at personalcapital.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems.